It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. When Arizona's conservative movement is put into historical context, Senator Barry Goldwater is mentioned prominently, which makes sense since he was known as Mr. Conservative and his 1964 presidential run, though it ended poorly for him, is credited with starting the movement that led to Ronald Reagan's 1980 election victory. In her book Sunbelt Capitalism, Phoenix and the Transformation of American Politics, Loyola of Chicago history professor Elizabeth Tandy Shermer explores where Phoenix's growth crossed paths with an expanding business presence and the conservative political push. Elizabeth, was there a collective civic effort to make Phoenix the Southwest city of record instead of, at the time, Tucson or El Paso?
It really was this tremendous movement among a new generation of boosters coming into the Chamber of Commerce. And this is Barry Goldwater and his generation. Because it's really interesting that his father's generation and his contemporaries were really fine with Phoenix being, you know, the capital city, but a largely agricultural town. And a pit stop, actually, to be honest, for a lot of the cattle and the copper and the tourism that is coming into Phoenix in that period. But Goldwater and his generation, I really make the argument that it was the trauma of the Great Depression and realizing that tying their fortunes, because these are the merchants, these are the lawyers, these are the bankers, these are the small town gentry, if you will, who had a sense that, you know, were well educated. Many of them were educated outside of Arizona, going to places like Stanford, Harvard Business School, University of Michigan, Georgetown, that we were educated. We have the professional acumen. We have the national connections to do better than just to see our fortunes rise and fall with the price of cotton. And this idea that we should have investment in Phoenix, that we should be a manufacturing center, that there's a ton of potential. One of my favorite things that they drafted with the coming of World War II is an actual survey of the potential of Maricopa County and what it actually could do. And you really have this sense that these are men with a vision for a modern metropolis that came together to do it, both within the Chamber of Commerce in terms of enticing industry, negotiating with war with defense contractors, but also to get, you know, deeply involved in politics. This is a story just as much about Phoenix's economic transformation as its political transformation.
How important was it to have these boosters who were pushing the area as a great place for people to start a new life, in essence?
Sorry, I'm going to push you back. It's the historian in me. Push you back to the trauma of the Great Depression.
Okay.
Because that greatest generation that we think of as the post-war generation, really their visceral memories are from the economic devastation and a lack of opportunity in Phoenix. And Phoenix during both the Great Depression, in terms of understanding just how devastating it would be to the city, but also World War II, when you see the promise of what it could be. In fact, one of the Phoenix boosters has this wonderful quote about how it seemed like New York City, the sidewalks were packed with not only war production workers, but military personnel, pilots being trained, and this sense about what the potential could be. But then when a lot of those military bases start to close down, when those war production factories start to shut down, even before the wars end, because it's very clear the war is ending, you don't need the contract still that has been negotiated with Goodyear. There's this sense of, what do we do now? We have had this influx of people. We have felt the potential that this is what lifted Phoenix out of the Depression. What now? And the answer was so clearly that we need jobs and investment. And I think that when you look at that very first pivotal city council race in 1949, when Barry Goldwater wins with the slate, with many of accompanied with other members of the Chamber of Commerce, it was this idea that we're going to put Phoenix on a sound business basis. But there is, as you sort of mentioned, there is concern about that it seems undemocratic.
How different was Phoenix from some of the larger, more established eastern cities? Why did it stand out so much? Was it just so vastly different?
It's amazing just the intimate connections that Phoenix had with some of those larger, more established cities. And the great city that Phoenix has all these connections to is Chicago, not only with the Benson brothers who ran Valley National Bank and also were key members of the Chamber of Commerce, but also with the connections to bring one of the first major investors into the Phoenix area after World War II, which was Motorola. And you can really see that connection. And when you actually look, there's an example in the book about how Phoenix, to be quite honest, stole Motorola from Chicago. It is this argument that this is not going to be a smoggy, ward politics-dominated kind of town. This is something different. This was warm weather. This was sunshine. This was starting over from scratch. This was the frontier of America for a new post-war affluent area. And that, I think, is really how Phoenix defined itself against those eastern cities. That whole sort of frontier ethos about the opportunity that lies out west, the newness, that's actually what makes Phoenix very much alike a lot of the other cities that are booming and growing in this period. Not only Los Angeles, which, you know, really sort of grows a little bit earlier, but San Diego is a great example. Denver, actually, Phoenix actually starts growing far earlier than that, but they're all sort of playing into this idea about a new post-war economy with far more intricate, far more skilled manufacturing, not just for consumers, but also for the military as well.
When you mentioned San Diego, Los Angeles, Denver, there's a feeling that Phoenix has an inferiority complex, and that's why sometimes the city and the state of Arizona do some things that might be considered pretty wacky, partly because, well, we're not going to let these other cities tell us what to do.
You know, it's really funny. A dear friend of mine wrote that came out right about the same time as my friend Jonathan Bell wrote a book called California Crucible, and we always joke that we should actually have written a book together about how Phoenix and California are in the great California cities that you were talking about, actually, you know, define themselves against one another. And for the Phoenix inferiority complex, you know, it's really funny. When you look in the early sort of stages of the book, the Phoenix boosters, those from the Chamber of Commerce, are going to urban California. They're looking at what the San Diego, the Los Angeles, and the San Francisco Chambers of Commerce have done to become cities that really are deeply enmeshed in the military-industrial complex coming out of World War I, and looking for ideas about how to get that kind of investment. And then you see that in the 1930s. You actually see it right after World War II, when the Chamber of Commerce is asking itself, how can we get new investment for all of these things pulling out? We have these empty factories that have now been abandoned. What do we do now? But the interesting thing about it is, you know, in the process of flat-out stealing industry, they do define themselves against high-tax, unionized California, and pass a lot of things in order to compete with California. My favorite example in the book is when you look at Sandra Day O'Connor about why she and her husband came back from the Bay Area, because they were both educated. They got their law degrees at Stanford, and then they did go overseas for a bit. Well, why did they go to Arizona? So they could take a part of that kind of politics. And again and again and again, William Rehnquist chooses to come to Arizona. It's true he hates Midwestern winters. He's from the West. But he comes because he says that he thought of Arizona as the last frontier for free enterprise. And that's how it was defining itself, against California, as at the same time that California, until the rise of Ronald Reagan, defining itself against Arizona, I think at least.
Elizabeth Tandy Shermer, she's a history professor at Loyola of Chicago and is author of the book Sunbelt Capitalism, Phoenix and the Transformation of American Politics.